Okay, I'm on a cordless microphone so that I can walk as I talk, and it sounds to me like it's working. Let me make sure. Would you raise your hand if two things are simultaneously true? You can't hear me and you want to? Okay. If at any point in the next 20 minutes those two tech specs are met at the same time, let me know and I'll go back to the regular microphone. I believe I'm the only speaker who is not a respiratory disease expert. I am a risk communication expert, and what I want to do in these 20 minutes is take you through some of the basics of the field of risk communication, and very quickly apply those basics to the various pandemic situations that you're likely to be in. Talking to a patient, talking to staff, talking to a patient's family, talking to your family, talking to the general public if you have an opportunity to talk to journalists or to write a column in your local newspaper, for example. And in all of those situations, you have an opportunity to talk about this pandemic. So I want to say some things about risk communication and how it applies to talking to people about this pandemic. Let me start with the most fundamental truth of risk communication, and I can summarize that truth in a number. If you make a long list of hazards and you rank order them in order of something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year, and then you take the same list of hazards and you rank order them in order of how upsetting they are to people, the correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. Those of you who have studied statistics may remember you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. If you know a risk is deadly, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's deadly. Now, several decades ago, trying to make sense out of that very low correlation, I coined terminology that sent my children to college and may send my grandchildren to college. So let me share it with you quickly. It starts with this word, risk. And what I did is I partitioned risk into its two principal components. Hazard, which is the redefinition or the new term I use to talk about what risk means to technical people. And outrage, which is what risk means to normal people. So you can think of this as the technical definition of risk and the cultural definition of risk, if you want. And the formula I coined, which, as I say, sent my children to college, is very simply risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, I do a lot of work with engineers. Engineers hate this formula. They find it terribly imprecise. So I have another version of the formula that I use when I'm working with engineers, and you folks may like that better as well. I would suggest that risk is a function of hazard and outrage. If you don't know what that means, that's hazard plus outrage in techie code. Now, this is a redefinition that makes a difference, and I want to make sure everybody understands why. The way the problem is usually seen, and remember, the problem is this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether you're going to kill people and whether you're going to hurt people. The way that problem is usually seen is as a problem of public misperception. And so my clients spend a lot of time complaining that the public just doesn't get it, just doesn't understand, just doesn't perceive the risk correctly. What this redefinition does is suggest something very different and much more symmetrical. What I'm arguing is that the experts, when they look at a risk, focus on the hazard and ignore the outrage. The experts, therefore, systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and the outrage is low. And the experts systematically underestimate the risk when the hazard is low and the outrage is high, because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. The public makes exactly the opposite mistake. The public focuses on the outrage and ignores the hazard. The public, therefore, overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and the hazard is low. Okay? And underestimates the risk when the outrage is low and the hazard is high. What I'm arguing is that this 0.2 correlation, far from being the result of public misperception, is, in fact, the result of a definitional dispute. I'm arguing that 0.2 is the genuine correlation between two nearly independent variables that have, in fact, only one interesting thing in common. They're both called risk by different groups of people. Now, they have one other interesting thing in common, and that is this. When outrage is high, hazard perception is very likely to be high. And when outrage is low, hazard perception is very likely to be low. And it's worth knowing, if you're trying to understand the core of risk communication, it's worth knowing the causal link between outrage and hazard perception. I want to make sure everybody is following this, and then we're going to talk about pandemics. When we look at the causal link between outrage and hazard perception, the question we're asking is this. When people get upset about a risk, are they upset because they think it's dangerous? Or do they think it's dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous and you wish they weren't upset, the solution is to convince them it's not dangerous. If they think it's dangerous because they're upset, then the solution is to stop upsetting them. Okay. So if we want to manage this system, we have to understand its causal structure. We don't want to be in the embarrassing position of trying to influence the cause by manipulating the effect. That's not good engineering, it's not good medicine, and it's not good risk communication either. So there's been a lot of research on that relationship, and the research shows overwhelmingly that it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions. But the arrow from outrage perception to hazard, I'm sorry, the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is very weak. And the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong. For the most part, in other words, it is not the case that people get upset because they think a risk is dangerous. It's much more the case that people think a risk is dangerous because they're upset. It is similarly not the case that people are calm because they think something is safe. It's much truer that people think something is safe because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. And off in a corner, we have actual hazard, whether people are going to die or not, which has virtually nothing to do with either variable. Okay. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Based on that, here is a list of what I call the outrage factors, the 12 most important components of outrage. So what I'm suggesting is that if a risk is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, and so on down the safe side of the list, you will be calm about it even if it kills you. Okay. And if a risk is coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and so on down the risky side, you are going to be upset even if it's not very dangerous. So if you're trying to get people to make a risk more upsetting, if you're trying to get people to take a risk more seriously, you are in the business of emphasizing to them the ways in which it's coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and so forth. And if you're trying to calm them down so that they won't get so upset, you are in the business of convincing them that after all, it's voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, and so forth. These components are most of what we mean, most of what normal people mean when they say something is high risk or low risk. All right, well, given that, What I want to do for you is very quickly sketch in the main kinds of risk communication and the implications of those main kinds of risk communication for talking about a pandemic. So we're going to graph outrage against hazard. Okay. And I want to point you to the interesting corners of the graph. We're going to start in the lower right-hand corner, the risks that are high in hazard and low in outrage, the risks that are very likely to hurt people or kill people, but not very likely to upset people. And you know what they are: smoking, eating too much, exercising too little. They're the risks that doctors give their patients a lot of hell about without much success. And these are the high hazard, low outrage risks. This is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. The essence of precaution advocacy is essentially to say to an audience, watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time. Okay. And in ways that should be clear to you, given what I've said so far, the very core of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. You're trying to, oh my God, I have only 5 minutes left and I haven't mentioned a pandemic yet. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase people's inclination to take precautions. In pandemic communication, that's going to be what you do when people are apathetic, when you're trying to convince complacent people that the pandemic could get serious, when you're trying to persuade your patients or anyone else in your life to take precautions, whether it's washing their hands or covering their cough or stockpiling a few weeks' worth of food. And some of the essence of precaution advocacy, okay, you need to keep your message brief because apathetic people, complacent people, don't listen for very long. You need to make it interesting because apathetic people are easily bored. You need to give people things to do because it turns out easier to convince people to take a precaution they think is foolish than it is to convince them that the precaution isn't foolish. And those of you who remember cognitive dissonance from your introductory psych class, if you can convince people to take a precaution, they will thereafter convince themselves that they must think pandemics are important, since after all, they're taking precautions about them. So you use action to change attitude rather than doing it the other way around. I'll say one more thing about pandemic precaution advocacy. Strike while the iron is hot. There are occasional moments when people are worried about pandemics. That's the time to do precaution advocacy. Unfortunately, when people are worried about pandemics, we become worried about the fact that they're worried. And what officials normally do is they try to do precaution advocacy when the audience is apathetic. As soon as the audience gets interested and concerned, the officials think, oh my God, people are scared. And we get an almost universal fear of fear, and suddenly, just when they would be able to be heard, they stop speaking. Okay. Second kind of risk communication, completely different, has nothing in common. Now the outrage is high and the hazard is low, and the task is outrage management. It's exactly the opposite. What you're trying, if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. Now, the message isn't calm down because people don't calm down when you say calm down, right? Especially if you say, calm down, you hysterical fool. That tends not to be a calming message. But the goal is indeed to calm people down, to reduce the outrage. When are we going to need to do pandemic outrage management? Well, we're going to have to do it if people can't be convinced that the pandemic is mild, as most of you know so far, and some of you may not. The pandemic so far is remarkably mild. It's got a lower case fatality rate than the seasonal flu in most parts of the world. There are people who will have trouble believing that. At the moment, officials are having trouble telling them so. But there are people who will have trouble believing that. If you have people who are worried about eating pork because they imagine that swine flu is carried by swine, if you have people who are worried about vaccine side effects, these are all opportunities for pandemic outrage management. I was going to tell you how to do that, or at least a little bit about how to do that, but in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to the third paradigm. If you find this interesting, from 1 to 2 o'clock, I'm going to continue, joined by my wife and colleague Jody Lenard, in Lehar, is that how it's pronounced? Lehar rooms 3 and 4, we'll do a whole hour on pandemic communication, and we'll back up and offer some specific guidelines on how to do pandemic precaution advocacy, how to do pandemic outrage management. Completely different skills. Meanwhile, let me finish this outline. In the third corner, we have crisis communication. If this pandemic turns severe, we will not have to warn people, you know, the fact that folks are dying in the street will do that job for us. We will not want to calm people down, since if folks are dying in the street, it's a good idea to take the risk seriously and to take precautions. So there's no arrow, but we will still have to do risk communication. If the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. The paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. Okay? And there are guidelines for pandemic crisis communication. I hope, as you hope, that we don't have to do that. But if we have to do that, it would behoove us to know how. It is yet a third set of communication skills. Just to finish out this graph, in the middle, we have what I call the smiley face. Down in the other empty corner, we have, I don't know if you can see it very clearly, I don't put a circle down there in the low hazard, low outrage corner. I have not found that to be a business opportunity. I earn my living as a consultant in the other three corners, you know, either helping to arouse outrage, helping to suppress outrage, or helping people to bear outrage. When people are appropriately apathetic about a genuinely trivial risk, there is not very little risk communication to do. What would you say? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. In the middle is the smiley face. That's where risk communication is easy. People are interested but not freaking out. The hazard is serious but not devastating. And a lot of doctor-patient communication happens there. The difficult doctor-patient communication happens in the other three corners.